Good morning. My name is Michael Earl, and I'm a female alcoholic. Woo, we really overslept this morning. I'm just kind of exhausted from what's going on in my life today. And the one thing I want to say is, you know, sometimes I think I sponsor too many women. Too many women. I'm so exhausted. I sponsor too many women. But when I have the hardest things hit me in my life, these women are there for me. You know, they totally get out of themselves and they hold me together. And that's basically what Lynn is doing right now. She thought she was coming to stay with me to help her. And she's the one, I'm begging her not to leave. I said, please don't leave. I need you. So I don't know who's sponsoring who. So anyway, I come from a line of sponsorship that comes down directly from Dr. Bob. And we do the steps a little differently. We do them exactly according to the big book, except that when we do step five, we do six, seven, and eight at one time. But I just want to read you a page in the big book. I believe this is Earl Treat, who started Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago. And I pulled it right out. Okay. So this is how Bob took people through the steps, and this is why Bill, we had six steps, and for spiritual reasons, Bill wanted to stretch them into 12. And at the moral inventory, they took the actions of six, seven, and eight. And so some of that, when I'm sharing some of my stuff, might come in to just the fear and the resentment, because I always take it all the way through, and I don't want to be doing someone else's step, so I'm going to try to do this a little differently than I normally do it. But at the bottom of, who has a third edition? A lot of you, you know, who still uses their third edition? Ah, well, we're so stubborn, aren't we? No, I got sober on that. I am not going to the fourth edition. I have all my notes in it. How many of you use the fourth edition? The room is about half and half. So anyway, down at the bottom of, if you're in the third edition, it's the bottom of 291. And if you're in the fourth edition, it's 262. At the very bottom, it says, the day before I was due to go back to Chicago, a Wednesday, and Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. Right there, that tells me that they did not spend weeks, months, years doing their steps. That basically, they went through them in 3 or 4 hours. They didn't have the big book to study, so that really helped, you know, because it's a lot of studying. But and I'm a person that really believes that just do some kind of an inventory. Just do something. Working the steps, because you can. Dr. Paul used to always say, you cannot do the steps too soon. If you miss things, it'll come up and you'll do another fourth, or it'll go on a tenth step. But you certainly can do a fourth step too late, you know, and you might drink before you ever get to that. My mom was one of those people. You know, I was talking yesterday that she never got a sponsor, she never worked her steps. And when she was dying of cancer, you know, the fellowship just surrounded me. And they were helping me take care of my mom, and they were taking care of me. And we would sit on the front porch, and we'd talk AA. And Mom would be in this hospital bed right near the window, and she would hear us talking a lot about AA. And one of the last things she said to me before she went into a coma was that, she never, ever realized how selfish and self-centered she was. And I think her hanging on as long as she hung on at those last 2 weeks, was her fear of dying, because she hadn't done the work. That she hadn't done the work in this book. And I went to a meeting, and I was just pretty hysterical, and I was crying to Frank Honeycutt. And he knew my mom from when she was in AA years ago. And I said, Mom won't die. She's just hanging on, and I think it's fear. She's been listening to so much AA with us, I think it's fear that she hasn't done the work. And Frank, we left the meeting, he said, get in the car. We have a saying in California, just get in the car. And anyway, so I got in the car with him and we drove over to the house. And he went in there, my mom's in a coma. And he took my mom's hand and he said, Marilyn, you know God loves a drunk. He loves a drunk whether they're drunk or sober. You can let go now. And my mom was able to pass. So I just hope people don't do these steps too late. And my very first inventory that I did, the first work I did, was the resentment I had was all on me. The book says that we have to look at our mistakes. Where were we to blame? And that's all I was focused on. But I am so thankful for that because it wasn't hard for me. I didn't have that many resentments towards other people. I just hated myself so much that that's what I started doing right from the very start. Excuse me. I'm going to pour this in a cup, my water. Okay. Anyway, I did enough to keep me sober until I could really do a thorough inventory and work the steps as I work them today. Anyway, so Wednesday in Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. The six steps were complete deflation, dependence and guidance from a higher power, moral inventory, confession, restitution, continue to work with other alcoholics. These are the actions that they took at the moral inventory. Dr. Bob led me through all of these steps, and at the moral inventory, he brought up some of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, ill tolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. We went over these at great length, and then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. This picture is still vivid. If I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. It was very impressive, and I wish every AA could have the benefit of this type of sponsorship today. And there you see the word sponsorship, or the word sponsors, which you don't see in the first 164 pages. Dr. Bob always emphasized the religious angle very strongly, and I think it helped. I know it helped me. Dr. Bob then led me through the restitution step, in which I made a list of all the persons I had harmed and worked out ways and means of slowly making restitution. So Bill took these actions that I just read, and he gave them numbers, and he just threw them in the book. And I don't know if you've noticed that on one page, you will see 6, 7, 8, and the beginning of 9 on one page. He writes very little about it. But when I talk inventory, I end up bringing these actions into it. And so I just want to qualify that's why I'm doing it. I'm not trying to do 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 all at the same time. I'm a fear-based person. I have always had fear of people, places, and things. And this fear was paralyzing me, absolutely paralyzing me. And I'm going to read this out of the book. Notice the word fear. This is page 67. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. I can identify to that because I am also a thief. And I guess that would go under character defects, but I had fear of being caught is what my fear was. So, I mean, fear caused me a lot of problems. It caused me many more problems than stealing ever did. And I'll go into some of those. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play a role he assigns. Just to that extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely upon him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for God. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. I'm a person who quotes pages in the Big Book. And the only reason I do that is because if I quote a page, you can take it to the bank. If I'm just sharing my experience, I mean, you can throw it in the trash because it's... It means nothing to anybody except for me. And so I want you to know the difference between what's in the book and my opinion. Because the book has never, ever, in 30 years, the book has never steered me wrong. And a lot of the times when I'm going through big, tragic things, I'll just open the book to wherever it opens and read what's on it. And almost every time there's something on that page that makes a difference in what I'm going through. This book is like my Bible. For other people, it's like my Bible. I guess because I'm alcoholic, I understand it better than I understand the Bible. But this is what I call, on my license plate, it says Big Book. Somebody said yesterday, God, you aren't too anonymous. Look at your license plate. I said, well, in the South, they think that means the good book. That's the truth, too, with a lot of non-alcoholics. Anyway, in the area that I lived in Long Beach, California, where I got sober and where I did most of my drinking, we had a lot of people who shared opinions from the podium. And newcomers tend to think that whoever's up here speaking or talking is some kind of a professional or somebody who knows everything, and they take what you say to heart. I mean, I've seen what people say from the podium do damage to other people, to newcomers. You know, this book says that if we need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. And I've seen people get up here at the podium and imply Prozac the steps. They're talking about an outside issue that doesn't belong in here. And I've seen people get off of medication, commit suicide, do all kinds of things because of what they heard from somebody at the podium. I mean, we are drunks. We are just as sick as you. Even though you're new and I have 30 years, believe me, there's no difference except for time. And a lot of effort that's been put into the recovery I have today. But anyway, in our area, we had a man who always said, if you have fear, you don't have any faith. You can't have fear and faith at the same time. If you have fear, you don't have any faith. And I just couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program, because I worked this program as hard as I could work this program. I've had many spiritual experiences, but I still had overwhelming fear. I mean, just fear that debilitated me. That's where my fear took me. It debilitated me. I even became agoraphobic. I went up to him and I said, why do I still have all this fear? I mean, I've done my steps. Why do I have all this fear? And he looked at me in the most arrogant, smug way and he says, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today I know I had taken a thorough third step. For me, the third step's a process. Now, this isn't for everybody, but for me, it's a process. It's not just words. Here, God, my will, my life. Those are just words. I can say that prayer, that third step prayer, and I love that prayer. It's so non-offensive to any religious affiliation, and it's the most beautiful prayer. But I'll say the third step prayer, and that turns out to be just words. I mean, I have to take action. I have to take action. And the actions that I take is 4 through 9. That's how I do a thorough inventory. Take the actions of 4 through 9. I went up to one of these old timers that was instrumental. Oh my goodness. I got up really late this morning. And I went, oh no. Lynn and I were running around trying to get ready. And so I'm still not quite awake, I think. Two men, they were brothers, Frank Honeycutt and Bill Honeycutt. And do any of you know those two men? You know, I'm always so amazed that I go all these places, and because he wasn't running around speaking, he did a little speaking, but I'm always amazed at the people that Frank touched and Bill touched, and Bill died before Frank did, but Bill was an old crotchety man, and he'd come in and he'd shove his cane at his seat and claim that seat, and if anybody sat in that seat, they were in big trouble. But he was just one of the biggest gifts in my early sobriety. So I went up to Bill Honeycutt, and I'm crying on his shoulder. I think I'm really telling on this other guy. He says, I don't have any faith because I still have fear. And I was just going on and on and on. And basically what Bill said is, he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it say you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to this page. Actually, here it is. He took me to this page 68, and he pointed out what I had just read to you, that all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, he said, Michael, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And I was like, duh. You know, then he took me down to the bottom of that paragraph where it gives you that little fear prayer. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And I use that fear prayer all the time. I'm still a person who has great fear. The difference today, because of working these steps and living in step 10, 11, and 12, is that I no longer let the fear debilitate me. I am willing to walk through fear today. Walking through fear is exercising faith. For me, walking through fear is exercising faith. And I'll tell you a couple situations I had dealing with the fear. I had fear of flying. Scared to death to fly. I didn't fly till I had 12 and a half years of sobriety. Two things that were the biggest fears that I've walked through. One was speaking at a podium. At 4 years of sobriety, I could not stand up here and read how it works. I couldn't do it. I never shared my story till I was 11 and a half years sober. It was a huge fear for me. And getting on airplanes, that was, I don't know which one was worse. They were both pretty equal. And when you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, you better be prepared for something to change. Little did I know I would be kicked like a football into this part of Alcoholics Anonymous where I had to get up at the podium and share my story all the time. My two biggest fears, getting on airplanes. Anyway, that first experience at the airport, I had a girl that was going to walk me through this fear. I mean, she was going to walk me, take me to the airport, get me on the plane. We were going to pray and do all this stuff. And she had an emergency, and at 6 o'clock in the morning... It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and she had to just drop me off. I mean, she just, like, kicked me out and threw my bags. And I went in there, and I checked in, and I'm waiting to go upstairs to where the planes are, and I just start to have a full-on panic attack. I'm a person that comes from panic. Panic attacks that literally, you know, I can't breathe when I'm having these panic attacks. My legs get so weak and buckle, and I go down. That's how my panic attacks affect me. And I started that hyperventilating, and I kept thinking, I can't get on that plane. And I finally collapsed. My knees were buckling, but I collapsed into a chair that was there. And thank God I started to cry, because crying always helps me when I'm in a panic attack. And anyway, at that point, I had a spiritual experience. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was not very sympathetic. It was like a stern, Michael, why don't you just get out of yourself and try and help somebody else? And I'm looking around, this isn't an AA meeting. Who am I going to help? And then I noticed at the escalator there was old people that were really struggling with their bags going up the escalator. And so that's how I started getting on airplanes. I'd run over and help anybody that needed help to get their bags up the escalator, or get their seeing-eyed dog, or to get their kids. I was just, sometimes they didn't know I was trying to be helpful, and it got to be a little bit of a scene, this poor little old lady fighting with me for her bag. So, but it's something that really worked for me, and it works for me today. I don't have that kind of fear of flying today. I have fear of flying. I don't have fear of flying. I have fear of crashing. Now, my sponsor told me I'd better be clear of what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. And, you know, one thing about fear is a natural instinct that God gave to us for survival. And so there's no way that God can remove a natural instinct. So in the 12 and 12, it talks about some of these instincts that have gone amok. You know, we just whether it's eating or gossiping or whatever, we just take it to the furthest end of destruction. And the book says that sometimes, the 12 and 12 says, sometimes we might have to settle for patient improvement. And that's what I had to do with this fear thing. Excuse me. So now I can get on the airplane and pretty much pray. And there's a certain page I read all the time. I was at a conference when I first started speaking, and I was counting the planes I was on. I could get up there on any day and tell you, I've been on 56 planes and I'm still afraid. And this guy came up to me in his real smug way. And I just always want to be teachable. And he pointed, I'm supposed to be the authority on the big book. How dare him? No, he comes up and he says, well, it sounds to me like you haven't read page 102. And I went, I have read the whole big book several times. So he opened it up, and I'm going to read to you what it says on 102. Let's see if I can find 102. This is what it says down at the bottom, second to the last paragraph. It says, your job now is to be at a place where you will be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. I've read that many times, but I had no recollection. I would have been reading that every time I got on an airplane if I had any memory of it. And that was such a comfort to me. That really did help me, that page. It's one I read still today a lot. What I do is I work with a treatment center. Every Wednesday night, these soldiers that are in a military treatment center, these soldiers come to my house every Wednesday night, and we get into the Big Book. And I always give them a mini copy of the Big Book. This is when they started going to Iraq. I started giving them a mini copy of the Big Book, and I would highlight that page of being of usefulness and God will keep you unharmed. And I've had soldiers read that and tears roll down their eyes. And I've had soldiers say, God, all the answers really are in the Big Book, aren't they? And it has made a huge impact on a lot of these soldiers that were going off to Iraq. It's funny how you can see your life unfolding and God there the whole time. You know, and you not knowing it. You have not a clue why you're going through what you're... And I don't believe God causes anything. I mean, I believe life happens on life's terms. And God can take a lemon and make lemonade out of it. But I can see how it unfolded by my having this fear and my sharing it at a podium, which I felt stupid doing. But I always share the truth up here. And sometimes sorry I did. anyway, and that guy coming up to me and giving me that paragraph, and that little interaction between the two of us has helped, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of soldiers going over to Iraq. It's just so amazing. So anyway, I told you how I get on airplanes, one of my biggest fears. We went to the bottom of the paragraph where it says, the last sentence says, at once we commenced to outgrow fear. It does not say, at once we outgrow fear. It says we commenced to outgrow fear. Big difference. And I can tell you today, I'm almost 30 years sober and I'm still commencing. I am still commencing. But that's covered in this book also. You know, it's covered in step 10 and 11. In step 10, it says that we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It says it is not an overnight matter, that it should continue for a lifetime. That was such a relief for me that I felt like I wasn't different. And then in step 11, it reiterates it. You know what, you have that paragraph on retiring at night, and the very first, it asks you seven questions. And the very first question is, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? That says, do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself that you should share with another person? And then it asks you some good things also, like were you kind and loving toward all? Were you packing into the mainstream of life? This is a constructive inventory, not destructive. The most powerful sentence in that paragraph for me was the question that said, what could you have done better? I do my 10th step in writing because I did my 4th step in writing. And, you know, with all the computers out today, everybody doing everything on the computer, I just don't think it has the same effect as when you're writing something. I mean, you can get a lot of emotions out by physically writing. You know, you can break your pencil, you can break your pen, you can just do it as hard as you need to do. So doing it on a computer wouldn't work for me, but it does work for a lot of people. They probably never did it in writing. They came in after computers were in full swing, and everybody's probably done their inventory on computer. But writing is very therapeutic for me. So if I had a situation where in that first question, was I selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? If that day I'd experienced one of those things, I write about it. I write about the situation. And on the question, what could you have done better? If I have a situation that I'm not real proud about my reactions, I write about it. I think about it. I pray about it. What could I have done differently? See, I can't change my behavior unless I know what I can change it to. So looking at it, how I could handle it differently, and writing it down on paper has made a huge impact on the way I react the next time to another situation. So that has been a very powerful tool for me. I told you that I had huge panic attacks, that I am a fear-based person. And my panic attacks, I mean, I'm 10 years sober now, and I had an experience where I almost picked up a drink because I hadn't been to a meeting in 2 weeks, and I wasn't working with others because I was much too busy growing in the business world. You know, I had this impressive job. I started out in the bottom in the accounting department and worked my way up to business manager after going back to school of this multi-million dollar corporation. It was musical theater. And I was at a birthday party for Debbie Reynolds, and everybody there was drinking socially. I mean, I've never really seen social drinking, so I don't know what it looks like. But it looked really good. They were all relaxed and calm, and I am just tight, and like I am right now. I'm just scared to death. I don't feel equal to, and that's how I feel. I've got to share that with you this morning. I don't feel equal to any of these other speakers. I think, why am I up here? And then I have to pray for God to just get me out of ego, because that's all about ego. It might be ego in reverse, but it's still all about ego. But that was my biggest fear this morning. And I've done this several times. I mean, I've done this a lot. I've done 12-step workshops by myself with my sponsor, done several of these Woodstocks. I don't know why I still get into this fear and thinking like I'm not good enough, or everybody's so far superior to me, and what am I doing here? But I still get into that kind of thinking. And those are old ideas. You know, the book talks about getting rid of all those old ideas. And those are old ideas, and they do creep back in for me. But I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to an extent. It is an asset that helps keep me out of getting into ego and thinking I know everything. I was a two-year wonder. Have any of you had that 2 years and you know everything there is to know about the big book and sponsoring, and you got it in with God? I was one of those two-year wonders. And, you know, the longer you're sober, I mean, the less you know. You just trudge through that happy road of destiny. And the great thing is today I can get up here and admit that I don't know. That's the great thing. I can admit it, and I can walk through that fear. But anyway, I had a little brain fart. Sorry. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble with my sponsor now for saying that word. What was I talking about? I know I was talking about fear. Oh, panic attacks. Sorry. Going off on a tangent. Okay, so I have these debilitating panic attacks, and they are getting worse, and they're getting worse, and they're getting worse. And I'd have them in the car. Later on, I started having panic attacks again at another period of my sobriety, but it would always be in the house, and I'd have to get out of the house. But at this point, I would have these panic attacks in the car driving. If I went anywhere near the city line, going out of the city I lived in, I would start having this panic attack, and I would have to turn around and go back. And what happened to me is at that point, I could drive to a meeting, I could drive to my house, and I could drive to work, and that was it. I could not drive anywhere else. I would just be so fearful, and I didn't even know what I was afraid of. But I would just start hyperventilating, and my knees would go out from underneath me, and sometimes I thought I was having a heart attack. I just didn't know, you know, what was going on. And one of the greatest gifts that at 10 years of sobriety, when I was having these kind of panic attacks, that Debbie Reynolds party I told you about, I don't know if I told you it was Debbie Reynolds, where I almost took a drink, I had a spiritual experience behind it. And what this did is I recommitted to this program at 10 years of sobriety, and I go to more meetings than I've ever gone to. I work with more drunks than I've ever worked with, because that experience where I almost took a drink, I found myself watching these people socially drinking, and I got into this keen alcoholic thinking that oh, maybe now that I have this very impressive job and I drive a brand new car and I have a house and an education and I'm not that little girl from the other side of the tracks, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. One healthy thing I've done for myself always is I do not have anonymity at work. And everybody knew I was sober in this program. And that's the only reason why I didn't drink that night, is I had enough respect for this program that I didn't want to drink in front of my coworkers. So I put it off, and I was going to drink the next day. This disease is truly cunning, baffling, and powerful. I'm an alcoholic that drank vodka down so much and so fast I stopped breathing and had to be brought back to life. But I can sit there and get into, oh, well, maybe now that I have a job... this impressive job, I won't drink until I die again. So anyway, the only reason why I didn't act on it is because I didn't want to embarrass the program, you know, in front of these people who really respected me, respected Alcoholics Anonymous, and respected my sobriety. The next day I had already plotted in my head I was going to drink the next day where nobody would see me. And this is just two weeks without being to a meeting. And so the next day I was asked to pay a 12-step call on a makeup artist. The executive director approached me. This makeup artist hasn't been to work in 2 weeks. He was held up in a motel. The motel was trying to get him out because he didn't pay his bill. And she asked me to go see what I could do. Really interfered with my plans. I did not... I did not want to go and see this guy, this drunk, who's not like the people I was with last night. And so I called a man went with me, and I knocked on the door, and I just identified myself. I said, Michael, alcoholic. I said, I'm Michael, an alcoholic. And he knew who I was, but I guess the alcoholic, he opened the door. If I had been held up in there, I would not have opened the door. I would not have opened the door. But he, I didn't recognize him. He's a makeup artist, and he had this wonderful blonde hair. This guy that's standing in front of me is bald-headed. Oh, who was it? Tom Iverson. I'm sorry, Tom. We were in the car last night. We went to see the lights, and we were talking about somebody who is follically impaired. I love that. Lynn and I started laughing so hard. Lynn, she goes, does that mean he was bald? anyway, he was bald. He didn't have that blonde wavy hair, and he was profusely sweating. He was so bloated. He looked 10 times bigger than he normally looked. He was bleeding from head to toe because he kept falling into objects. He smelled of alcohol, he smelled of urine, and he smelled of vomit. And as I stood there looking at him, I was speechless. I was just speechless. And I had that inner voice that I get at times talk to me again. And it's not me, and it's not through my ears, but it is so loud in my head. And that inner voice said, Michael, you are not like the people you were with last night. If you drink again, you're standing in front of a mirror. And I want to tell you, That night, I got my Fanny into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recommitted to this program. I got a new sponsor. I did the steps the way I do them now. I had already been through that the way Dr. Bob does it. And my sponsor that I got was the only other person I knew that sponsored that way, where you did step 5, you did 6, 7, and 8 all at one time. It was just a total God thing. And she is the one who has kicked my butt when it comes to fear, walking through fear. The thing I wanted to point out about, there is fear that's healthy and unhealthy fear. And I used to always talk about that when I was doing, you know, like step work or doing a 12-step workshop. I would always say, you know, when you're writing down that defect of character, what you want to do is you want to write down what you're afraid of. Because if it's a healthy fear, you don't say just fear. that your defect of character is fear. I always say unhealthy fear. Because God can't remove fear. It's a natural instinct. And I need that. I need that so I will not cross the street on a red light, that I won't stand there and be defiant if a man's got a knife on me. There's reasons for that fear. So fear and unhealthy fear. So anyway, I've got this new sponsor. And I always get sponsors that help me, give me actions to take with my character defects. Like when I stole all the time, and I don't know how you give up that defect of character. And she just had me every day call her in the morning, commit not to steal. And I'd have to call her at night and let her know if I kept the commitment. And if I did not keep the commitment, that was okay. But I just had to be accountable for what I was doing, because I did this stuff and I wasn't even aware I was doing it. And I can tell you, from that day to this day, I have not stolen anything since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had that huge emotional displacement rearrangement. You know, I am a totally different person today. I can't even believe I was the person that I'm telling you about. But I was, and that's why it's good for me to share it, because it reminds me where I came from. I need that after 30 years of my life being so good. Not perfect, but so good. I'm having such a hard time. I'm very sorry. I'm going to say a little prayer right now. You can pray with me. Thank you. I'm doing this out of context, I guess. So I've got this new sponsor, and her name is Polly. And I know you all know who Polly is. And she is just the sweetest little thing. Oh, my, she's just wonderful. And I met her at a Christmas party. Not a Christmas party. The meeting was canceled that night. And so it was held at somebody's house. And so we had this intimate meeting at somebody's house. And I was sharing about my sponsor dying, my mother having cancer, her first bout with cancer, and how I was using the steps to get through it. And Polly came up to me, and I don't know what I said, but she said, "You need to be sharing from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'm going, "Oh, who are you?" I didn't even know her then. And of course, I'm just, there's no way I am sharing ever from the podium. That's not in the big book. That's not how we stay sober. My program is working one-to-one with another drunk, and I do believe that is my program. This is a gift God has given me to walk through fears, to meet my husband, to change my life, and to open my world, really open my world from that little teeny world I had in Long Beach, going from work, home, and to meetings. He's opened my world with this. But anyway, when it came to getting on going in cars and driving out of the city, I couldn't do that. And she would tell me, Polly would tell me, "Okay, why don't you get in the car, get on the freeway, and get off on the first exit?" Because at that point, this fear had taken me to the point where I couldn't drive on freeways at all. I couldn't get on them at all. And then the next day, she had me get on the freeway and get off on the second exit. And then get on the freeway and get off on the third exit. And that's how I started commencing to outgrow that fear I had of getting on freeways and having these severe panic attacks. Another thing that helped me a lot, I was in a meeting. There was a woman there, and I'd never seen her before. But she was sharing about having agoraphobia. I didn't even know what agoraphobia is. I guess it's fear of fear, but her agoraphobia was what it did is it took her from exactly where I was at, and it progressed to where she was housebound. She hadn't left the house in 2.5 years. And as she was sharing this, I knew that's what it was happening to me, that if I didn't do something, I was going to end up housebound. I knew that. So all of this stuff is just coming together at the same time. On speaking, you know, Polly was really on my case about it. The day that I asked her to be my sponsor, I said, "I know you sponsor a lot of women and you're really busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but do you think you might sponsor me? She was so wonderful. Oh, I'd love to sponsor you. And she just picked me up and she hugged me and she goes, I feel so privileged that you asked me to be your sponsor. Isn't that wonderful for somebody who's so busy? And I know somebody was talking to me about another speaker this weekend that she just really idolizes, but she doesn't want to call her. She wants to call her, but she doesn't want to call her because she's so busy. She sponsors so many people. It'll be an imposition. It's not an imposition. I mean, believe me, it's the one thing that keeps us sober, and it's the one thing that helps us when we're going through trials and low spots. And this person, who I think she's here, and she knows who I'm talking about, is going through a trial and low spot today. So I think that would be you helping her if you gave her that call. Anyway, so Polly finally, eventually, she just worked on me and worked on me and worked on me about this plane thing and that it's a character defect, and I better be clear on what the defect was. It's not fear of flying. I had to admit the fear was of crashing and put it down on paper. And how she got me to speak is she was very, very sick, almost had pneumonia, and she sent me to a little meeting in Long Beach and to speak in her place. And I just became willing to do whatever she told me to do because I didn't want to drink again, and I knew how close I had come to drinking. And so I went and shared my story. I went 20 minutes over. I don't know what I'm doing. And so, but I got invited to speak at three other places from there. And then somebody sent my talk to a taper, and all of a sudden I get this call where I was invited to speak in another country, in Canada. I wasn't even getting on airplanes yet. And how did they know about me in Canada? I just didn't get it. I didn't understand that tapers trade tapes and stuff like that. It was all just new to me. But that was the process where I started walking through all my fears, you know, trying to help her because she was so sick. I was willing to walk through that fear and share at that meeting, and then asked to share at other meetings. And I had to get in cars and drive 2 and 3 hours to a place to speak locally in California, if you call that locally. So it was just a process of slowly taking little teeny steps that allowed me to walk through all these fears. And even though I'm still afraid, I'm terrified when I get up at the podium, I'm still afraid getting on airplanes, but I do it anyway. I do it anyway, and for a long time I wouldn't. And what that is, that allowed me to meet my husband. I used to tell Polly, I think God wants me to be single because, I mean, look at all the women I sponsor and how much work I do in AA, and I don't have time to date or have a relationship or go look for anybody. And Polly would say, God doesn't create some people to be single and some people to be married. She said, that's a natural instinct God has given us, so you better just be open to it. And anyway, I was speaking in South Carolina, and I met my husband, and he is just one of the greatest gifts in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. He's just such a blessing in my life. And that would not have happened to me if I wasn't willing to walk through these fears. I wouldn't know any of you. I wouldn't know Dick, who I just love so much because he's a man who walks like he talks. He has boundless energy, and I don't understand it because I don't have that boundless energy. But so many, Tom, I mean, the people that have, and Brookins, I'm just looking at all the people who have touched my life, Linda and Bob, they've touched my life because I had the willingness to walk through fear. They taught me how to have relationships. I didn't know how to have a relationship. I started speaking a lot on the East Coast. On the West Coast, a lot of those speakers are womanizers. But on... You might have to strike that on this tape. Lee, a lot of them are womanizers, and that's what I was kind of used to. And I started speaking at conferences on the East Coast, and I was meeting people like Keith Lewis, Dick, Brookins, Tom. I cannot tell you all the couples that I met, and I watched them have relationships. I watched the men get up at the podium and say their wife was their very best friend. And it just changed my perspective on relationships. I don't think I would have ever been ready for the marriage I have today if I hadn't gone through that process of watching all these couples that I had so much respect for, because these couples were true to each other. They behaved themselves at conferences. I mean, I saw a lot of things that, you know, I just felt, you know, they were hypocrites, and why are they at the podium anyway? No, I didn't have any judgmentalness, but... Oh, my God. You know what happens to me, too, is every time I get into being judgmental, I end up walking in your shoes, experiencing your experience to get over the judgment. And that's a heavy price to pay. I used to judge speakers that didn't attend every meeting and attend all the other speakers. I judged them harshly. I was at everything. And then, you know, my back went bad on me. I had 3 back surgeries. I couldn't even sit in a chair. I'd end up going and speaking for my commitment and up in my room the rest of the time, laying down with my legs up on the wall. I mean, just all kinds of things, you know, that just proved to me, you know, maybe they had reasons for not being at every meeting, you know, but that's what I have to do. I have to walk through their shoes to get over the judgment. And so today when I find myself getting into judgment, I am on my knees, immediately on my knees, praying for this judgment to just go away, because there's usually something in back of it that I do not want to have to experience. One of them is this weight gain, and I have a real fear of being fat. And I am fat. But in California, I was very thin. I worked very hard at my, which was another character defect, food, compulsive overeating. I was very fat when I got into this program. And I worked very hard on that defective character. And I was a size 4 and a size 6 for, I don't know, 12, 13 years, 14 years. And we had a speaker speaking at the podium at my home group, Seal Beach. And she hadn't been speaking for a while, so everyone was so excited. It was just a big buzz that she was going to be speaking, and I was so excited to hear her, and because I hadn't heard her before. And when she got up there, she was fat. She was like 300 pounds. And I sat there in my little size 4 or 6 body, and I'm thinking, my, she must not be working 6 and 7. So what happens to me? I get to move to Georgia, get married. I don't have the support group that I had for all my life. And I had these back surgeries. I'm on medication, steroids. I can't exercise. All those things that just go into it, where I got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now I'm at the podium. And some of you, I bet, are thinking, my, I bet she's not working 6 and 7. So that's another little demonstration of my having to walk in somebody else's shoes. So, but those are such good things for me to grow. I mean, I have really grown a lot from these experiences. So anyway, fear touches me in every area of my life. I have fear every day. I have fear of my daughter dying. You know, I just know how it felt when my mom died, and I don't want to have that feeling again. So I have fear of my daughter dying. And what I get to do is just tell people about it. And so many people are praying for my daughter. And what happened the day I came here, Thursday, I had to meet with the hospice team. And she has liver disease. She has cirrhosis of the liver. And she hasn't had a drink in 20 years. She looks like she's pregnant with quadruplets. I mean, her stomach is so big. She's about 400 pounds, too. And she's just so hard to manipulate and to move. But anyway, hospice met with me on her care treatment plan. And what they did is they took labs again, and her ammonia level was not at the level that qualified for hospice. I don't know what that's about. You know, I don't want to get into thinking, you know, hopeful or anything, but I just know since I've shared it from the podium about Alcoholics Anonymous, which the first time was just, I guess, this month or last month, I started sharing it, and all these people are praying for her, and they're sending me letters of prayer, and it's just like this circle of prayer going around, and all of a sudden she's taken off of hospice. I'm afraid of that, because, I mean, it's hard taking care of her. You know, it is hard for me to take care of her. And they were, you know, great help for me. But I just walk through that fear. I suit up and show up every day, and I'm just the best mom that I can be. Alcoholic women that are moms have a lot of guilt, And that guilt, you know, a lot of our guilt and our pain from the past, we do this work and it heals. But it's like a little scar, you know, a sore or a cut that hurts, and then it heals over. And if you go back and you start scratching at it and picking at it, you'll get it to bleed again. And I just don't want to do that. So I just suit up and I show up and I try to be the best mom that I can be. I've been the best mom I could be for 30 years. My daughter is totally dependent on me. That wasn't what I had in mind for making amends, but 44 years old and she's totally dependent on me, and I had to take her 12-year-old daughter into our home. So now I'm in my golden years raising a 12-year-old. And that wasn't in my plans for my husband. And so, but we just suit up and we show up, and we whatever God puts in front of us, we just do the very best we can, and we leave the results to God. So anyway, I still have a lot of fear. I have fear of what's going on in my life. I have fear of health problems because I was so debilitated with health problems. I still have all these fears, but I just ask God to remove that fear and direct my attention to what he'd have me be. I'm always directed to work with another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. One of my favorite pages in the big book, bottom of 14, top of 15, says, "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those trials and low spots ahead." We're guaranteed trials and low spots. Life still happens on life's terms. And just getting out of myself, getting on my knees, asking God to remove the fear so I can function. For me, I'm always directed to help someone else. And I totally, for that period of time, do not think about me and my problems. And then God can get in there and take care of something. Now about sex. I hate that one. Anyway, the one thing I want to tell you that I do with the fear inventory is, and I also have a format that I pass out when I do a workshop, but it's geared towards Dr. Bob taking you through the steps. So it's just when you do step 5, you do 6, 7, and 8. But on the fear inventory, it's just 2 columns. Some people make it 3 columns because there's that part that says, was it because self-reliance failed us? Well, that can go in the second column that says, the first column is, what are you afraid of and why do you have that fear? And I almost have something that I can always put in that second column of why I have that fear. You know, I have claustrophobia really bad, really bad. But I mean, I was tied up as a kid a lot at poles and trees, and it'd be nighttime and no one found me, and I'd be covered with blankets and trapped in these blankets that really mean kids lived around the neighborhood. And there's just a whole lot of reasons for that claustrophobia. And I got to look at that and see why I had it. Fear of flying. I had a friend that was on a plane. I don't know if you remember the Canary Island crash. She was on that plane when that it crashed. And so that helped create the fear of flying. Of course, it wasn't the fear of flying. It was the fear of crashing. Every fear that I have, I can almost trace back to where it came from. And sometimes I can't figure it out till years later. I'm listening to somebody I sponsor share about something. And that right there. What time is it, Lee? How much time do I have? 10? 15, okay. I guess I better get on with fear. And then in the second column, we divide the fear into those two columns. You put, what is a fear and why do you have it? And if self-reliance failed you, you just put that in the column that says, why do you have it? Self-reliance failed me. So I don't think you need to do those three columns. I think it only needs to be done in two. But if three works, that's good. Now about sex. Oh. It says that we have to write down people that we have hurt because of our sex conduct. Not people who hurt us. If somebody hurt us, it goes under resentment. This is who have we hurt because of our sex conduct. And a lot of time, people just think that has to do with sex. Who have I had sex with? You know, and it goes way beyond that. The person that I hurt the most because of my sex conduct was my daughter. I hurt her the most. And when you get to the column that says, did you arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? I aroused all those in my daughter. I lied to my daughter all the time. I told her I'd come home and I wouldn't come home. And she always thought I preferred a man over her. And a lot of bitterness, a lot of jealousy over anybody I was seeing. And sometimes I had her in very unhealthy situations that I'm not proud of. I'm not proud, and I can bring up that icky feeling just talking about it from the podium. A lot of things with my daughter, still, I can scratch that scar and get it to bleed real easy. So it was my daughter that I hurt the most. And there is, in the book, it says, what could you have done instead? So it has these columns that are similar to the resentment, but it's a little bit different because you've got the word inconsiderate in there. Was your part inconsiderate? Oh, I'd say my part was inconsiderate there. And then it says, what could you have done instead? And that column's different for everybody. You know, for me, I might put, I had an abortion. So I hurt an unborn baby. I had an abortion. I had to fill out the rest of it, and then what could I have done instead? Well, for some people, it might be practice safe sex. For other people, it might be you don't have sex unless you're married. For someone else, it might be, you know, you need to be monogamous. For me, it was like abstain, abstain, abstain. So it wasn't hard for me to abstain when I got here. Of course I hurt myself, and I know some people say you don't put yourself on your on who you hurt or on your inventory, but I do. I'm resentful at myself because of all this stuff before I even start my resentments on other people. And then on the sex inventory, I hurt myself almost as much as I hurt my daughter. I degraded myself. I had such self-loathing. You know, I was reduced to prostitution in my drinking. That's another thing that came out at the podium by accident. I'm speaking in a big meeting, and I had stuffed that. The last time I prostituted, I was 6 months sober, and I was on my ninth step. And I had stuffed that. I had a little spiritual experience behind it. Like God saying, every time it starts out with Michael, I know it's not me talking. It says, Michael, you know this is not God's will for you. And so that was and I had such a sick feeling. I just knew I could never do it again. And so I hurt myself with that prostitution. That self-loathing, everything that came out of prostitution, and I justified it sometimes. Well, I had to get food for my daughter. No, I had to get alcohol is what I had to get. And so my alcoholism reduced me to prostitution. So that's what I put for hurting myself. I hurt myself also by getting pregnant and having an abortion. That was not easy for me. That was not. Some people don't have problems with. I mean, I'm not. I don't have any pro-life or pro-life. And what's the other thing called? Or yeah, personal choice. I don't have any opinion in that area. I just know I had that abortion, and it was like an assembly line. They just had lines of women on these gurneys to go in there, and it was awful. And afterwards, I just felt grief of what I had done, just awful grief. So I not only hurt that child, I hurt myself. And so I do have to put myself, for me, this is personal for me, on my sex inventory. I hurt my husband. I cheated on him. And what could I have done instead? Be faithful. What else is on my inventory? I hurt my mom. I got married at the age of 15 to get out of my home life. But I wasn't pregnant. Believe it or not, I was a good girl at 15. But I hurt my mom by that was part of, I put it under sex conduct. I don't know why, but I really hurt my mom a lot by getting married at 15 and moving out of the house. Well, I lied to her and I said I was pregnant, you know, and I had to get married. So I hurt my mom. I hurt some of the men that I slept with. Venereal diseases were transmitted. So if someone gave me a venereal disease, they call it something else today, but I'm still in the old school. If someone gave me a venereal disease, it goes under resentment. But my passing it on to other people goes under, who have I harmed because of my sex conduct? That's the first time I've ever admitted this from the podium, the venereal disease part. I hate that when it just jumps out there, it comes out, and you want to just take it back. I hurt a lot of boyfriends that I had that I loved. I hurt two of my husbands. The other husband went under resentments. I'm on my last husband, my fourth marriage. But those are the kinds of things that go under your sex. Who have you hurt because of your sex conduct? And it's really important to that column that says what could you have done instead? For everybody, it's different. There's no pat answer. Like having an abortion for somebody, their answer would be under what could they have done instead? They would say practice safe sex, or be on birth control pills, or, you know, in a place where they couldn't get pregnant. For me, you know, I had to put on, in that column, I could have abstained and lived up to my morals. Because I had morals. I had high morals. And I didn't even try to live up to them at that point in my life. So it's different for everybody. It tells you to ask God to help mold your ideals for your future conduct, your future sex life. And I've always written out things like, I want a monogamous relationship, and I want him to be an AA, and I want him to be spiritual, and all this stuff. The last time I did a sex inventory with Polly, and she, this is what we do, is we have them at the end of their sex inventory, they write out what their ideal is for their future sex life. So what I wrote out for my ideal was love and marriage. That's all, love and marriage. I didn't want marriage without love, and I didn't want sex without marriage. And shortly after that, I met my husband. I lived in California. He lived in Georgia. It's hard to get together when you live that far apart. So, I mean, there was no problem with sex until after we got married. But I really feel like a lot of that is because I had been with these guys. I'd watch couples and how they had how their marriages were. I learned just watching them and being with them. I always felt like a fifth wheel because I didn't have a partner, but I hung around with all these married people. But they taught me so much. They really taught me how to have a relationship, and what I wouldn't, sometimes the serenity prayer, people talk about acceptance, accept, accept, accept. And sometimes people forget about the part that says the courage to change the things that we can. You know, there are some things that are unacceptable. And if it's something unacceptable, we need the courage to change it. And I had a couple relationships before my husband, and I mean, I immediately got out of them because there was something unacceptable. And I've never done that. I've always stayed in there until they left me. I would never leave anybody, especially my first AA marriage. You know, I would never get out of that because this is an AA marriage. It's a spiritual marriage. He started using the next day after we got married, and I got to go to Al-Anon with all of his drinking and using. But anyway, I want to apologize for being so scattered up here, but I want to apologize for sleeping in late, and I want to give you all these excuses. But I did say a prayer for God to just talk through me, and so I hope somebody got something, because it didn't come from me, it came from God. Thank you.